You are listening to Serve, Protect, Lead, a podcast from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, where you will hear from IACP leadership and police leaders across the globe sharing wisdom, insight, and perspective.
Hello, everyone. My name is Christina Fernandez, and I'm a program manager at the IACP. This is our fourth podcast on the topic of the IACP's Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, which provides police leaders with peer-to-peer assistance and resources as they navigate the unique complexities and challenges in the aftermath of a mass violence incident. Our focus today will be on the effect of mass violence incidents on first responder families, how agencies can better support families, and what families can do to help their officers and each other heal in the aftermath of one of these tragedies. I am honored to be joined today by Michael Kehoe, retired chief of police of the Newtown, Connecticut Police Department, who was one of the first officers on scene following the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting of 2012, and his wife, Lori Kehoe. Lori is a retired nurse who took on a very active advocate role with the families following Sandy Hook. We're very, very lucky to have them today to talk about their experiences. And I'd like to just go ahead and start by having Chief Kehoe, having you set the stage for us a little bit. Tell us what that first experience was for you when you heard the call for service. You knew something was happening that was serious. You arrive on scene. Tell us what that was like for you.
Yes, good morning. And certainly the date was December 14th, 2012. It was just a normal day for me and for the agency. You know, lots of activity from the patrol division and the detective division. I think it was an all hands on deck call immediately when dispatch notified at least those in the building that there was a potential active shooter at Sandy Hook Elementary School. So that necessitated an all hands on deck response from everybody available that was in the community or in the building. And going to the scene, you kind of go through your head, what may be going on? Why would we get a call like that? That's always in every officer's mind as they go to calls. They kind of want almost in some ways kind of understand as much as they can what kind of scene they're going into and what will they have to do to tactically, go to the scene. And so while you're going to the scene, you're listening to other radio transmissions and they're updating you as much as they can. And arriving at Sandy Hook Elementary School with other officers simultaneously or just seconds later, we knew we had to confront the shooter if indeed there was a shooter. And of course we now know there was a shooter. Upon our arrival, most of the shooting had stopped, so we needed to enter the school to determine, if there was more threats or threats existing in the school. And it became a very chaotic scene, as you can imagine, once we discovered that children and adults had been shot and killed.
Lori, when did you first hear about the shooting? And what was your process? How were you getting information about what was going on?
Being married to an officer for 34 years, I tuned out the news. So I got a call at 9:30 in the morning. My sister called and said, "Did you hear there was a shooting in Newtown?" And I went, yeah. Because I grew up, my father was an airline captain back in the 60s and the 70s where people panicked. So I grew up in a family where you weren't afraid. And so I said, well, there's shootings all over sometimes. And I didn't pay much attention to it. And I went back to work. And at 1:30, a female attorney friend of mine who I work closely with called me and said, "Did you hear what happened today?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, you need to come over." And I said, "Okay, I have to come anyway." She said, "No, you need to come now." And she was cute. She knew I liked Asti Spumante. So she kept an 8-ounce bottle in the refrigerator for me. And when I walked in the door, the news was on. And she handed me the bottle of Asti and said, "You're going to need this today." And again, you can't panic because there's nothing you can do. And Mike was on the TV. And I said to myself, well, he's alive. He's standing up. He's okay. Next. And I kind of refused to deal with it. And I tend to write my own rules. So I said to myself, well, they have cots at the PD. They have food. They have showers. I probably won't see him till Monday because this was a Friday morning. And I stayed with my girlfriend. We watched the news for a really long time. Quite a few people called me through the day after that to make sure that I was all right. And he showed up about, I don't know, 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, which surprised me. And we went from there.
At that point in time, what you're thinking is this is a critical incident. We've dealt with them before. This is not that unusual. We're prepared. We know what to do, right? He's responded to many of them before.
I had no inside info at that point.
Yeah.
You know, because I was the chief's wife, I was the chief's wife. So I wasn't really welcome in the social community of the wives. And so there was nobody from the PD calling me and updating me, or no wife saying, oh, I heard this, I heard that. So, you know, there's a lot of isolation that can come with it. You know, you don't know what to think. But when he got home at, I don't know, middle of the night, we have a new phrase that developed. I got it covered. I got it covered. Because he woke up and I volunteered. I said, do you need me to answer phones, to do anything? Nope, I got it covered. And I drove into town the next day and I said, I got to figure out what I got it covered means. And I don't know, how many officers did you usually have on a shift?
Well, we had a lot of, you know, obviously help from neighboring communities. So we had a lot of help from, you know, support, a lot of support systems already in place. So when it came time to, you know, what can Lori do, you know, to help from the family perspective?
Yeah,
we were trying to figure that out.
We'll get into that a lot because that's really what we want to focus on today. But Mike, you know, going back to that, like, you've dealt with all critical incidents. At what point did you realize that this is different and this isn't going to maybe follow the same path that other incidents have followed? This is unique for me, for my officers, for my family. This is nothing like we've dealt with before.
Right. That's a good question, Christina. I think it was, you know, probably almost immediately. You know, we hadn't had an active shooter situation in our community before. We had trained for it. But you never, if you think about an active shooter, you hope that there's not a lot of casualties. In this particular case, there was a lot of casualties in a very vulnerable, you know, educational institution. So knowing that it was going to be impactful was just the number of people were showing up. You know, that, you know, parents and community leaders VIPs, political VIPs. So you knew that was going to be a big deal, especially when the media started showing up with their satellite trucks. And it became a national story, understandably so. But that's when you kind of start to hit and you start to say, listen, this is going to be huge. And you start to almost in your mind think about what are my next steps? You know, and that's what you start to focus really in on that.
So you're trying to make sense of all of that. And Lori, at what point did the families start to get brought into the process of being told what was going on and getting information about next steps, support available to them, if at all? How did that sort of start to happen?
Well, it kind of dawned on me probably Saturday. We developed a routine. Mike would leave about 6 in the morning and come home somewhere between 10 and midnight. And Saturday night, I don't know if it was Friday night or Saturday night, he said to me, the president will probably come to town on Sunday. And at that point, you realize it's getting big. It's getting real big. And being a hospice nurse by trade, And having been with the same department for, like I said, 34 years, I had never had any contact from anybody to help you with anything. So I brought up and I kind of was a little pushy. And I said to Mike, you need to bring the families together. I don't have time. I said, well, we got human resources. I said, well, give me their phone number. I'll take care of it. And
Actually, it was EAP that had we had obviously we had EAP within our agency, and they support not only officers, but they support families too.
So I called her, and let's just say my experience wasn't what I had hoped. I said to her, you know, we need to bring the families together to educate them on when they see a problem and where to go and how to identify a problem with the officers. Because most people don't have any clue on that. And she said, well, everybody has the 800 number. And I said, what 800 number? I said, I've been around for 34 years and I've never seen an 800 number. So I got real pushy. And on Monday night, they had a meeting. Mike and EAP coordinated it. They had a private meeting at one of the schools, I think. And I think I reached out to all the families. I think he gave me a list. And I called them all and said, this is what we're going to do. I hope you can attend. If you can't attend, send somebody else that's important in the officer's life. You know, it doesn't really matter who. And we had a really good response.
Yeah, it was a relatively very good response. When you think about trying to get families together, I think this is one of those circumstances where they came together as a police family and wanted to know maybe what would be the next steps for themselves and for their own families and for their officer, spouse.
Well, the other thing that happened was when the president came to town, I wormed my way into that event because the communication, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on. And of course, I was not at the top of the list. And Mike connected me with one of the other chiefs and he made sure I got in. And they sat me with the teachers that had been in the incident and they sat me with the officers. And I walked down the aisle. And you could see all these big, strong officers trying not to cry. Okay. So, you know, I knew that that reinforced the next night's meeting, that people needed to have a clue what these guys were going through. And that education is always number one.
Well, I think you highlighted something really important, which is that the supports that are in place have to be culturally competent. They have to understand the group that they're helping out and that they're supporting. And it sounds like that wasn't in place. And in this situation, even more so, they have to understand this culture and this world and then this type of incident. So I think that just highlights how your experience highlights how important that was. And also, I love you for being pushy because you had to be. Someone had to be. That was really important that you took on that role and you saw that there was a need there. So I'm going to ask you a lot of questions about that because I think other spouses in other situations, I want them to hear this and say, you know what? I might have to take charge of this. I might have to own this a little bit because otherwise the families aren't going to get what they need. And so you were really active in doing that. Do you think that you talked about seeing these officers having this reaction, and we always talk about how in law enforcement, we have a tendency to want to keep the families separate because we don't want them to see or know about all the difficult things that as officers face. In this instance, do you think that bringing them together helped heal or helped bring some sort of support to each other during this?
Well, I can't help but think it probably did. I unfortunately was not included or had the opportunity to be involved in the follow-up. There were a lot of organizations that came in after. There were a lot of opportunities for families I know to go for seminars and such. I mean, I think if you were to ask Mike, he probably couldn't list all the people that stepped up and said, I can help, I can help. And, you know, not knowing who to trust.
Yeah, that, but that, I think that was the jump start of getting families involved early, I think, which is very critical. So if there's a lesson to be learned from this, obviously get those families involved as early as you can, not knowing when that may be. That could be, that could be, that could change from incident to incident. And certainly the capabilities you have to do that. So, but I think that was a jumpstart for that. And that's a great lesson to be learned from that. You know, start that family process as soon as possible, if indeed you haven't done it in advance.
That would be part of the, I mean, I hate to say it, but we obviously know that these incidents could strike at any time. Mm-hmm. And every agency should have a plan in place for how to deal with that and how to respond to that. Should the families be part of that process right from the beginning, from the, in the preparation phase? And if so, what does that look like? How do we ensure that they have a role, that they, their support is in the forefront? Because there's a lot going on. So like figuring that out during is challenging.
Well, I think the problem we've got is we know somewhat about doesn't work, for instance, because after this, some of us gals got together and we talked the state police into letting us attend a graduation. And we tried to say, hey, if there's a problem, here's the 800 number. Here's the number. This is where you would go. Nobody wanted to hear a word. They were busy celebrating the graduations, which looking back, it made sense. So, you know, unfortunately, these are the type of incidents that nobody wants to get involved in until they happen. You know, if you called me up and I'm working, you know, double shifts with four kids, I'm not going to have time to come in and sit and be on a committee to do what if.
Yeah, I would say that many of the training academies are now incorporating wellness into their training of basic training of police officers. Whether or not they're extending out to the families is another thing. And how much time are they giving to, you know, the wellness piece, the you know, the long-term wellness piece of, you know, a recruit to say, listen, we want you to have a full healthy career of 20, 25, 30 years, whatever that may be. We know they're getting some basic stuff in the academy. In most academies now, I think we've come a long way with that. The question is, are we kind of updating it later on? Is it being taught again, or you know, we call recertification training, in 2, 4, or 5 years in increments of that. And I think that's important too. So the two pieces come together. You know, certainly talking about, you know, the training that the officers will get before they go on the road, and the training they get after they get on the road, and whether or not it includes a family piece to it.
I think it's important. I mean, that's one of the things we were hoping to get involved in. It was, you know, having it be part of the curriculum, whether it's part of the original curriculum or, like Mike says, the follow-up curriculum. I think the families should be brought in. Okay. A lot of the officers want to totally separate the family from home. I mean, the family from work. And, you know, if you do that, I think my personal opinion is I think the officers stuff it and the spouses don't know what's going on and they don't understand if he's having a bad day or he's been to a bad call or what's happening. So, you know, if you don't educate the important people in their life, you know, Mike and I just had that conversation before we started, the husbands, the wives, the girlfriends, the moms, the dads, the brothers, the cousins, somebody they live with, you know, whoever it is, because people do not identify, you know, the key risk factors.
So I guess when we talk about the support system, everybody has a, what their support system will look differently. Obviously, we have the support system that exists with internally in the police agency, and then of course you got your family or friends support system, and that could go, it looks a lot different with each individual. So once you identify your support system, you want to reconnect with them. Because there is an isolation piece to that after a tragic event. And it's just part of the healing process in some ways, or the protection process that officers have. And also the coping. Maybe they're coping by being isolated a little bit, thinking through and self-talking about what happened to me, why did this happen? And all those questions that come up of doubt when these kind of situations occur.
And people don't realize that alcohol and misbehavior are the first two signs of lacking failure to cope. You know, I mean, I went to PTSD treatment a year after the incident because I was not functioning because I had heard all of the details. And I had no idea that alcohol is the first indicator. So if you never drank before and all of a sudden you're drinking, you know, the family support system needs to identify that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what you both said is so important is that family can be defined very broadly, right? It's not the same for everybody. And, it doesn't necessarily have to be someone that you're related to by blood or even marriage. We talk about sometimes that you have recruits who are going through the academy. They're far removed from where they grew up and where they live. And maybe their family in that moment is another recruit or someone else in the department. And that's who their support system is. So we have to be a little bit more inclusive as far as what we consider to be family. And Lori, to your point, I think we're kind of looking at it as what does the family need in terms of support, which is incredibly critical and important. But what you're saying is the family are the ones who can identify changes in behavior and warning signs because they know that person better than anybody else. And so you have to equip them with the understanding of what to look for and what things could indicate that something is not right and that their officer is struggling in some ways. And I know you were very direct with Mike when you saw something that made you concerned. And I think you were the one holding up the mirror, right? Being like, hey, I think you need some support yourself here. And so I want to kind of talk a little bit about that, if you all don't mind, just sort of what were your experiences? And Mike, I know you've got a tough cookie there at home with you. So if she told me that I needed some support, I would listen to her and speak. But how did that,
Are you talking about Danbury
covered,
Hospital?
got it covered. Maybe I don't have it covered.
Yeah, are you talking about Danbury Hospital? Is that the one you're talking about, the visit that he got?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I happen to know a lot of people. And one of them was a nurse that worked in Danbury Hospital. And, Mike doesn't show stress. He shows it in agitation or pacing. But other than that, he's very, very level-headed. And I don't know what I was identifying at the time. I can't remember, but oh, I know what it was. You were questioning. His big concern was officer suicide. Okay, he was very, very concerned that his officers got the services they needed, so there would be none of that. And because he already had a tremendous amount of guilt.
I would add one other thing. That was one of them is certainly harming themselves, and the other one would be that I didn't want officers to leave the job because of this event prematurely. Okay, and all the fallout that could happen from an event like that, any other fallouts would be that they would, be different officers going down the road. They would be different family members now going down the road, and now you'd have fractures occurring in those arenas. So those things were really playing into a concern that I had about, gee, what are our next steps from the mental health perspective, and not only our officers, but for the family members too, so we can give them as much support as possible.
What really I was concerned about was the level of responsibility and guilt he was carrying. Okay, because he felt he was responsible for all these kids that were not here anymore. And he was responsible because they were his kids. That's not really come out. He read to these kids 6 months before. These were his school. He was the DARE officer there for years. Okay, so he had a sense of guilt and a sense of responsibility for these officers. So I knew a girl in Danbury Hospital, and I said to him, I would like you to talk to somebody. And of course, he gave me the old, I don't have time. And I said, well, I'll make time. And he goes, well, whatever. I said, well, do you give me? Because you know, in the psychiatric world, if the call doesn't come from him, they're not going to talk to me. I said, do you give me permission to get a hold of the head of the Danbury Psychiatric Department and have him call you? Yeah. So I called, and again, he said to me, is this you calling or is this your husband calling? And I said, my husband doesn't have the time to call you. And yes, this is him calling. And is there a chance you would meet with him? And he did. He called Mike. He went to his office, I think on a Saturday morning, and he sat with him. I don't know how long. And he reassured Mike that his thought process was going down the right pike. And that's all I thought he needed at the time. You know, just he was questioning a lot. And I just thought, well, talk to somebody who can really work with you on that. And the guy was wonderful.
He was very good. He was actually already in the community. He lived in the community, and was also, I think, helping with community services for, in a psychological perspective.
So were you glad that Lori made you have that conversation?
Absolutely. I mean, it kind of it kind of gave me a little bit of understanding about, what potential services we could bring to bear for this event. I would say the doctor was very upfront with me. He says, I don't know if I'm equipped to work with police officers, in this realm, and you might want to, reach out to others, and gave us some thoughts and ideas on that. So the whole aim behind that was that I was on a right pathway and a right trajectory to start the healing process, the recovery process for the agency and the officers and civilian staff, in the agency.
I'm going to ask you both a follow-up question. Lori, if you, what would be your advice to family members who see that their officer is struggling and this is a hard conversation to have with them, right? How do you recommend sort of bringing that up? How do you think that conversation could go so that they feel comfortable saying to their officer, like, I think you need help. I think this is not going well. And Mike, from your perspective, how can they better hear that? Like, what are the words that might help open that floodgate and open that conversation up?
Well, that's a really challenging question because every relationship is different. Okay, I've had many wives say to me, why do you want to know? Why do you listen? Why do you go to the conventions? That's his problem, not yours. Okay. I've had family members say to me, why does it affect you so much? It was his incident, not yours. Okay. So I think it depends on your relationship. If you got a nurse you're married to, or mama's a nurse, or dad's a nurse, you know, you probably have an open relationship with people that are more educated. If you have a relationship where you do your thing, I'll do my thing, I think that conversation is much more difficult because a lot of cops do not want to be called on the carpet. You know, there are, you know, wonderful men that will listen and have the conversation. And then you got the guys with the egos. Anybody with an ego and you challenge them under stress, it's probably not going to be heard. However, you can rally the other friends and you can do some protective work in the meantime. You know, it's not unreasonable to ask your partner not to drink so much. It's not unreasonable to ask your partner to go to counseling. Personally, I think everybody should have a personal counselor. We've had one for many years. We go 2, 3, 4, 5 years without talking to them. And if there's something that comes up, we go in for 2 to 6 sessions and we're done for a while. I think everybody should have that. Unfortunately, you know, it's a cultural change going on. And I really think that comes down to the relationship.
Well, I think that leads into my answer to you, Christina, in that as a police chief, I think, you know, your rank and file and others probably look at you as somebody who's probably the strength of the agency. And that, yeah, they've seen it all, done it all. But if you can show that you're just as vulnerable as they are, and that's important, so that you're willing to see, you know, you're willing to seek out help and get professional mental health, that it kind of sends a message to those officers that it's okay. You're in the same boat as they are. So I think that would be the number one thing that I would say to anybody in leadership positions, so that you're as vulnerable as they are.
Well, and I think that's what one of the things that you've been working on. When Mike has spoke, you know, years after, he would speak to the upper echelon, because until the chief and the commandant and the lieutenant and the sergeant buy into it, that that's not a bad thing, and you don't lose your job because you're going to go get some help, you know, you're not going to see a full change. Because we've seen so many episodes where, you know, how do I say, the camaraderie, you know, the best buddy, the co-worker has gone to the higher ups and says, you know, Steve really needs help. And they go, yeah, he's doing fine. Get back out there. And next thing you know, Steve's committed suicide. You know, so until, like Mike said, until the top, it gets accepted and put into the system from the top down. Because again, the people that are closest to the officers are the ones that are going to see it.
So I want to dig into that a little bit more and sort of talk about, from both of your perspectives, what were the things that were affecting the families the most? What were the things that were stressing the families the most, or that they felt were most challenging? And what are some of the strategies that you can use to help give them support and provide them with whatever they might need during that time? I think there were probably some things that were surprisingly stressful, or you were not thinking about. So what are some of the things that the families were responding to or were affecting them?
Yeah, I think initially there was an unknown for the families. This is something new that they were concerned, just like my wife was concerned about, you know, the mental health of the spouse. And I think that became the educational piece. And giving them enough information about mental health and what can you expect from these kinds of situations was a big key of moving forward. And of course, now we have to then reconnect with the family in any way, or family and friends, to try to get back to a normal, because you can withdraw a little bit. And for a variety of different reasons, now you really got to reconnect with the families, so that you all as a group, as a support system, can heal too. And therefore the, you know, the agency has to kind of be a little bit flexible in allowing for that to happen. If there's no flexibility, you can't alleviate those pressures that are existing agency-wise and family-wise. You know, it's there. It's just now you kind of have to think outside the box and say, how can we relieve the pressures of these, you know, that's existing from these traumatic events?
Well, and all the rules go out the window. At least they did for Mike. Everybody got Christmas Day off. Everybody, all of the other officers in the state showed up. The Jewish officer showed up. One of the other chief, well, yeah, Doug showed up. He's, you know, and Mike and I went to the police department very early. He wanted to thank all the officers. And here's this Jewish guy, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas. And, you know, everybody came together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if somebody wanted time off, there was no question. You just gave them time off.
Yeah, we adopted a policy of if you needed time off to be with your family, you could take time off. And it wouldn't even count against your personal time off that you normally earn and in your work. And that was, again, so that they feel like they were spending time with their family. And if they wanted to take a vacation with their family, that we thought that was a good thing to do. We allowed that to happen for a period of time. I think that was that flexibility that we adopted. I think that was very helpful to many, many families that were able to do that.
Well, the other thing, you know, that really factored into this and being able to do that was Newtown was a very small department, but the community and the other police departments freely sent officers. And so they had a huge pool. If he felt like he needed another, I don't know, 5-10 officers, he'd just call up that other chief and say, hey, who can you spare? And they willingly sent. So, you know, you have to ask for help. You have to be educated. You have to be flexible.
We also have to recognize that there, you may need some extra help along the way, and don't be afraid to ask. I think, other agencies will offer personnel as necessary. That's just the kind of work we do on a routine basis. But sometimes you feel like you're actually maybe imposing in some ways. Recognizing that, yes, this is an unusual and unimaginable event. And it takes thinking outside the box to kind of maneuver through this event and the aftermath of it.
So I guess, you know, looping kind of back around to the families and sort of what we've learned from this, I'm going to ask each of you, what are three lessons learned from the incident, the aftermath, as it pertains to families that you would want another agency who's going through something like this to know that you wish you had known? That was a lot of words and a lot of questions, but basically, what are your top three lessons learned?
Top three, I would say, number one, you need to educate whether before or after an event, okay, and educate not only the officer, but the family on, you know, that even if you don't go through a tragic event, there's trauma throughout a career of a police officer, and that these are the things you should be looking for. And if you do, here's where your resources are for that. And there is help and there is hope, okay, that you can get past that. So that would be number one. Number two, I would say as an agency, try to be as flexible, think outside the box to help every single person who works in the agency to get through this, to heal and to recover. And three, I would think that maybe you need a person like Lori. Maybe I would call them the family peer support manager, where they could take charge, okay, and maybe get some things done. If you don't have that in advance, you sometimes by necessity, you develop that. And I think that those kind of three things may help you. And if I want to just kind of caveat to that a little bit, please, you know, have a mental health incident manager, you know, somebody who either is, you know, associated with the agency, and utilize them to help the entire agency and families.
All right. We all need someone like Lori. But Lori, what are your top three things?
Probably the first one would be to, if there is an avenue to connect with the families in the PD, to do so. Okay. And not to be afraid to ask for help. I know ICP has been working very hard for the last 11 years. Are we at 11, I think?
12, almost.
12. to get a rapid response team to go in. You know, if you are notified that people are willing to talk to you or help you, you know, keep the number handy on the right day, pick up the phone. You know, if Chief Keogh's name has been given out and the wife wants to talk, I'm sure they could ask for Chief Keogh's wife. You know, they have to reach out. Because these incidents, I think the biggest problem, one of the biggest problems I had after the fact, was it's not going away. Okay, this is not, I was in a group where a mental health professional said, you know, the first year, the fifth year, and the year the kids don't graduate from high school are going to be the worst years. And after 10 years, it'll be over. Okay. And then all these shootings. Okay. It got to the point where, you know, originally I couldn't even look at a five-year-old. I would burst into tears. I'd have to walk away. And then a couple of other things that, you know, it doesn't end. It changes. It evolves. But society, you know, we are doing nothing about it as a community. We are tolerating it. We're tolerating it in so many different ways. And I think number three, I think one of the lessons I would say is the media uses you. Okay. In the beginning, I encouraged Mike to do his share on the media. You know, Christmas Day, they called our house and they wanted interviews. And I didn't interfere or talk bad about it. But in the last 5 years, it's become evident that nothing's going to change and nothing he's going to say on the news is going to make a difference. And they use you. They use you for their storylines. You know, if you want to make a change, that's not the way.
Honest, and your experience reflects that what we continue to see in the media, all of the incidents that we continue to see. Yeah, it's not going away. And mm-hmm. and every time I feel like when I ask you both to talk about these feelings and all these things that happen, you know, I feel like I'm ripping off the Band-Aid a little bit, and I feel terrible about doing that. But I think it's important for our members to understand what you both experienced. But there's other ways that Band-Aid gets ripped off as well. And so every time you see something like that on the news or something, you know, reminds you of that. And Lori, I think it's just so important that you mentioned that. You know, you could be in a grocery store and see a child and that brings back a lot of feelings. So I think that's also important for everyone to understand that grief and trauma sneak up on you sometimes, and they affect you in times and places sometimes that you're not necessarily prepared for. And it's okay, right? And it takes as long as it takes to process all of that.
And no matter what you do, you can't prevent it.
Right. Right.
You know, we moved to Florida and didn't tell anybody we moved to Florida. We went to hide for our retirement. We didn't want anybody to know who we were. And Parkland happened, right? I don't know how close was Parkland. Pretty close.
2 hours.
Okay. And, you know, and Mike knew I was having a hard time with it. And he said, let's go to the pool. You know, my mother turned off the news. I said, let's go to the pool. They didn't tell me it happened. We go to the pool and they're all talking about it. He finally drags me out in the middle of the pool. He says, I have to tell you something. Parkland happened. I said, who's Parkland? And I look, he goes, it was another school. And I said, just tell me how many. And he goes, 17. I said, okay, I don't want to talk about it. Move on. Now I know about it. Let's move on. Because it's not stopping.
A whole other aspect to this, right? That it just... there's so much that continues to happen that brings it all forward again. So, but again, I know that the two of you and the openness and the willingness that you have to share is so important. And that's the only way that we're going to get through all of that is if people are willing to ask for help and talk about their feelings and support each other in the aftermath. It's the only way. So thank you both for taking the time to talk to us today and for being so honest about your experiences.
I thank you both.
Well, thank you. Because, if we can educate people, that's the first step.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, Chief Keogh is a valued member of our Mass Violence Advisory Initiative. Lori, I consider you a member as well.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. You're both so critical to what we do. And so thank you again for your willingness to share this information and to help police leaders in a way that only someone who's walked in your shoes can do that. So to our listeners, if you'd like to learn more about the Mass Violence Advisory Initiative, please visit our webpage at www.theiacp.org/MVAI. This concludes our podcast today. Be well.